Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California, and it's broadcast number 492, May the 10th, 1981. I had some thoughts about Mother's Day, but that occasion will be long gone by the time this tape reaches many people. And if I have time, I'll get to that later. But I think I'll just jump into the subject that I want to speak about this evening. And that subject is the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Justice Department, and the way they go about investigating the assassination of either the president or a candidate like Senator Robert Kennedy, and particularly in this case of John Hinckley Jr. shooting down four people in Washington, D.C., one of them being the president of the United States with that bullet 1 inch from his heart. He's still somewhat immobilized, and Mr. Brady, James Brady, is still in the hospital with serious brain surgeries. He had three surgeries already. And I want to go into the role of the federal agencies and what they've done from March the 30th up to this date of May the 10th. In April the 4th of 1981, the New York Post had some interesting articles, items on their front page. It was called "Many Loose Ends on Hinckley's Role, a Top Aide Admits." Now, that was just 1 month before the FBI issued a report, which made me furious this week, on their conclusions of the case without having interviewed Mr. John Hinckley himself. A month ago, the New York Post wrote, "The mystery deepened yesterday about the shooting of President Reagan as the FBI began to probe whether accused John Warnock Hinckley may have had accomplices. The Justice Department said to the Post they still maintain he acted alone out of a twisted fantasy over actress Jodie Foster, but they are uncovering evidence that raises new questions about the 25-year-old loner's actions. The evidence includes two unexplained phone calls made from Hinckley's downtown Washington hotel room hours before he stalked the Reagan motorcade, a mystery man identified by the Secret Service as a potential assassin was spotted in the same crowd as Hinckley, acting in a herky-jerky manner. New evidence will come out to show that the investigators are looking into persons that Hinckley tried to telephone himself the day of the shooting, and while he's being tested in North Carolina at the federal institution, they are going into further details from the front desk of the hotel where he anxiously inquired where there were messages, the sources said. Another mystery man in the crowd said witnesses saw a man resembling Hinckley outside the Washington Hilton Hotel, and the Secret Service agents also quickly spotted him. The one resembling him, of course, is the one I'm somewhat interested in. And Mr. Knight of the Secret Service said the unidentified man was interviewed. The agents questioned him, and they ascertained that he posed no threat. So there was one man as a diversionary acting a little bit silly, but one that resembled Hinckley. And there always are these doubles nearby the scene of the assassination or the assassination attempts. A Washington law enforcement source said videotapes of the shooting showed camera flash bulbs going off from an angle suggestive that private citizens standing near the president and on the other side may have aimed their cameras directly at the gunman as he fired the .22 caliber pistol. Well, these were some of the remarks in the New York Post just a month ago, April 4th, 1981. Now, getting back to Hinckley and the report this week from the Justice Department and the FBI, I want to clarify and go into detail, maybe for the last time or update it later, exactly what transpired at my home and what followed afterwards as with regards to this particular person. April 21st of this year, just a few weeks ago, Neil Goodman of the Secret Service came to my home. He worked 3 years with Mondale, Vice President Mondale, overseas and domestically, so he was one of the top echelon of the Secret Service. He was assigned to Vice President Mondale. He came down from San Francisco. We talked about John Hinckley. We talked about the Hinckley family and my concern that the story was being completely covered up and why I was concerned. And then we got to the subject of the similarities of the person that had been in front of my house that I had written the details on. I had taken a license car number. His name was John. He was in a white car. He looked spaced out as if he was under some kind of control. I had been exposing Nazis involved in the political assassinations, and just a few weeks earlier in the San Francisco Chronicle, there was an article about Mae Brussel linking Nazis everywhere from the John Kennedy assassination to the John Lennon murder. And he was a member of the Posse Comitatus. This is one of the most violent groups in the country. It's a combination of the Klan, the Nazis, and the former Minutemen, and they teach shooting. This organization that Hinckley belonged to has locations in California, Colorado, and Wisconsin. And the man who founded it in 1974, this was after the Watergate episode cooled off, was a member of a group called the William Dudley Pele's Groups. The older people who listen to this show remember Pele. During the 30s, it was the Silver Shirts. They were violently anti-Semitic. And the tenet of this goes that people should control law and order with guns in their own communities. And, of course, Hinckley was allegedly kicked out because he wanted to shoot people and blow things up. He was active in the group. The group has a lot of activity going on in Wisconsin right now. And recently, in 1980, they had a pamphlet called The American Farmer, the 20th Century Slave, saying that Jews can't farm, Jews control the world, they want to control the international monetary system, Jesus wasn't a Jew, the Holocaust never existed, and they're described as a fundamentalist paramilitary Christian organization with close links to the Klan and former members of the Minutemen and the vigilantes that were active in 1960. Well, the Minutemen in Southern California were active with Donald Segretti, I mentioned last week briefly, who worked for Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary for Richard Nixon, and he worked with the Republicans, and Dwight Chapin was closely linked to Clement Stone, who's involved in Christian fundamentalist Christian organizations and turning the world Christian, and linked to these also to the fringe of these paramilitary operations. So I mentioned that this article had been in the newspaper about me in the Chronicle, and a few weeks later, a car that they identified as being registered from San Francisco was at the house. And this person had wanted to live in my house or do electrical work, and finally said to me, I pressed the point, where are you from? And they said Santa Barbara, and that is also the residence of Ronald Reagan down in Santa Barbara when he takes time out now. Well, what happened when Neil Goodman came to my house? After we talked, he took out a Polaroid camera and asked to take a picture of me. He then gave me a piece of paper and asked me if I would sign it, and it was permission for the Secret Service to go to any doctors that I had ever had to get a record of my physical condition and also any psychiatrist that I might have been to. That they don't want to break into the offices. They want to know what psychiatrist. So they wanted permission for psychiatric files. Then they took my passport number. He had me get my passport and show him the number and wrote down my Social Security number and my driver's license and asked for the names of my children and asked for the name of my ex-husband and where he works. And then they gave me a handwriting card, which I had an option to fill out, which I filled out but didn't give back to him, which reads, the people of the United States, that's one sentence, then states pay taxes to support is another sentence, and then the government. And then they have other words, skilled hands, your country, money letter, public law, official reason, and so forth. They have about eight sentences, and it has space to write it in a script and then print and then script the letters, and down below you print the sentences, and then you print the letters, and you sign your name, and he signs his name, and then you put the way you write all your numbers. And I said, for what purposes do you want me to do this, fill this out for you? And I might have mentioned this on KLRB before, but I've done so many radio programs from my home, I don't remember. I did three today, one in Chicago and 2 hours up at KZAP. So It's hard to recall some of the times that I've passed this on to you. We're doing so many broadcasts I'm doing on the telephone. But he had me take this card, which I didn't return to him, and I said, I see no reason. And the remark was, well, in case anybody sends a letter threatening the President of the United States, we can say, you didn't do it because we have a sample of your handwriting. And 2 days later, April 23rd, two FBI men, local men, came to my house to talk about the matter of whether or not this was Hinckley at the home. And they took the same information from me. And the point is that if it wasn't Hinckley, would it be one of the recognized doubles or the man that the Secret Service or the police saw in Washington, D.C.? They saw a Hinckley lookalike at the shootout at the Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C. An editor and publisher magazine in Houston, Texas, printed a picture of John Hinckley, and then they printed a picture of another fellow Nazi named James Gaither Whittem, who was arrested in 1977 for distributing Nazi literature. The first picture of John Hinckley in St. Louis in his uniform was denied as not being him, and they retracted that statement. But besides that, in the same Nazi organization that he belonged to, in the Posse Comitatus and that group, I have with me a picture here of James Gaither Whittem, and you would never find a closer parallel in hair, neck, mouth, and face. And at first that story was printed that he was at this rally, and that was Hinckley there in the Nazi party, and later this statement was challenged, the Associated Press story was challenged, and they identified this was Whittem and not Hinckley. But the result of this, it came out of an Oklahoma newspaper at the trial of distributing the Nazi literature, and the other picture was taken in St. Louis. But after this was printed, the authorities came to the Oklahoma newspaper and demanded that the controversial photos should be removed and the files all destroyed. So all the pictures and files have been destroyed after 48 hours after the story broke. But I do have and was lucky enough to get in my possession a picture of the two men that were identical. So it would be interesting to know if it wasn't Hinckley at the house, was it James Gaither Whittem, or was Whittem also in front of the Hilton Hotel at the time of the shootout, or was there a third person, as there were three Lee Harvey Oswalds in the Texas School Book Depository the day that John Kennedy was killed in November 1963. One was up on the fifth floor, one left the depository out the back door, and one left the front. So whether he was at the house or wasn't at the house, I would have liked to know who the car was registered to. But they told me, I spoke again to the FBI this week, and they told me that they sent a picture of the man who has the car registered in San Francisco back to Washington. I said, was it Hinckley? They said, we can't tell you. I said, you won't tell me. No, you will probably never know. If it wasn't Hinckley, we won't tell you. No, it wasn't Hinckley. And if it was Hinckley, we won't tell you, because that is the Right to Privacy Act, and we can't tell you. We have to protect his privacy. So I say, okay, here's a man who's heavily armed, who's too violent for the Posse Comitatus, who is seen by everybody gunning four people down in Washington, D.C., and crosses state lines and is possibly wanting to get into my home and parked up above in front of my window, and I don't even get the courtesy of knowing it wasn't him. And they said, no, we won't even tell you if it wasn't him. Well, now I go on to some more of John Hinckley apropos of the thoroughness of the agency. The Washington Post this last week, and it was in the San Jose Mercury, and maybe you saw it or maybe you didn't, had an article on John Hinckley based on a 1,000-page report of the FBI done in this time interim while Hinckley is locked up in the federal institution and known for its brainwashing and sanitizing. The title of the article is, Hinckley was not stalking Reagan. If he wasn't stalking, I don't know who was, but this is the theme of the article. This is a quotation of Charles Ruff, the U.S. attorney, and I'm going to get back to him again some more on this program. He said, "I expect no imminent action in this case." That's the U.S. attorney who I mentioned briefly last week is going to be removed from the case because he wanted to prosecute John Hinckley. And this week he said, "I expect no imminent." And the words of the article I'm quoting to you are the key point about this story so far. There are no indictments expected for at least 2 months. A task force, this is the Washington Post, of 50 FBI agents assisted by District of Columbia Police, Secret Service agents, and part-time efforts of 700 agents in nearly every one of five dozen FBI offices is working on pre-trial investigations. 60 FBI offices, 50 agents, 700 other agents, and spread out around the country. And this is their quotation. "The FBI is continuing this investigation, but the prosecutors in the U.S. District Court here have said they have never seen such a meticulous effort by the FBI." That may be true, but it's startling. Special Agent Larry Knisely, K-N-I-S-E-L-Y, and get your pencil out, I'll give you some phone numbers later, said, "We are investigating for history." Well, I love history, so that's up my alley. He said, "We will interview anyone who could possibly help us understand Hinckley or the incident." Well, I think I'm someone, and they said anyone, so of course I called Larry Knisely. Then Theodore Gardner, special agent in charge of the Washington field office, says, "This effort is not only to prepare the prosecutors for the trial, but to avoid the kind of questions that have plagued previous assassination investigations involving high-ranking public officials. The reason this is such a meticulous effort and they will interview anyone is to avoid the kind of questions that have plagued them because they did such a lousy job before." Well, those of you who know me and know my research and other researchers know they can't avoid those questions in the future any more than they could cover up Watergate or John Kennedy or Martin Luther King or any of them, precisely because they never ask the questions they should be asking, and private citizens like myself and others who have no vested interest in asking those questions get the answers when we learn to ask the questions. Now, another important point is this. At the time of Watergate, when they were caught, the CIA and the FBI with their fingers in this pie, at the time of Watergate, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, with acting director Patrick Gray, who was deep-sixing and dunking in the river valuable papers and taking them home, he'd just replaced J. Edgar Hoover a month earlier, he agreed with the Central Intelligence Agency and Richard Helms that they had an agreement that if the FBI should get into any area where the CIA was involved, they would back off, that spies, assassins, traitors to this country get preferential treatment. Now, that is something you listeners have to learn and get into your heads, that if the FBI finds anything where the CIA is involved, the FBI backs off, and the CIA is the gospel truth. And remember, in this assassination attempt, that if Ronald Reagan were murdered, or if he slows down or gets sick as a result of this and is weakened, George Bush, the director of the CIA, is top priority and is vice president of the United States. Now, in a book called Watergate, The Full Inside Story, it was published by Ballantyne, and there were four authors of this book, and one of them was William Shawcross, maybe you know his name from other investigations, described as soon as the arrest came after the Watergate break-in, 3 days later by June 20th, the FBI went into Bernard Barker's bank and found this icky money from Mexico that went into the Republican funds. And then CIA agents, four of the five burglars, were currently with the CIA, and one suspicious, Martinez, was a retainer. They all worked for the CIA. So Patrick Gray went to Richard Helms about the possibility of the CIA involvement. And in this book, Watergate, and the chapter called Deep Six, where Patrick Gray destroys the evidence, they said the whole affair was embarrassing, And it was the president's wish to call on Mr. Walters. Now, Mr. Walters, Vernon Walters, has just been sent as the aide to Alexander Haig to start a bloodbath down in Guatemala. And it's that same Walters that was called upon. He was the deputy director of the CIA under Helms at the time, acting director Patrick Gray went to him to talk about that iffy area of the CIA. And they said as they left the White House, Richard Helms of the CIA told Walters, their deputy director, to remind Patrick Gray of the FBI that the FBI and the CIA have a delineation agreement whereby neither will upset the other's apple cart. If one runs into the operation of the other, it simply discreetly passes the information along. And Walters agreed on that and went right over to the FBI, to Patrick Gray, and relayed that message because Gray was new that there is an agreement that when the FBI taps a CIA murder, assassination, stealing the elections, etc., then the FBI, no matter what the truth, no matter what the justice, no matter how many offices, 60 FBI offices, field agents, 700 agents all over the country, forget it. If you tap an FBI fund, an FBI agent, they label it national security and you wouldn't want to betray your country. And that's why they can't avoid the kind of questions that have plagued this country continuously, because it's a contradiction to investigate and to protect at the same time, because every one of these murders goes back to the CIA. Now, I called Special Agent Larry Nicely in Washington, D.C., who said we are investigating for history. And I said, I'm very fond of American history, and I've done some work on it myself, and I told him my interest in the case. He said, we can't take the information from you. And I said, you said you would talk to anyone. And he said, well, we can't take it from Washington. And I said, well, how do we arrange this? He said, your local FBI agents have to discuss it with you. I said, the two local FBI agents in Monterey Peninsula, Mr. Millerup and Mr. Cummings, told me that when they came to my house, they could only discuss whether the car in front of my house could have been one that John Hinckley was using, and they couldn't talk about conspiracy. The orders have to come from you. And if you don't tell them to come back to my house, and I wanted to tape record what I said to them in the house, and the agent said, we forbid you to do it. I said, well, I want to know that what I said to you that is in truth what you're going to write up. They said, we forbid you. And I was automatically, he was very angry. I couldn't tape record what they said, and they couldn't talk about it. So the FBI was at the house. We talked about Hinckley. We couldn't talk about conspiracy, rampant conspiracy going on at every level involving the highest levels of intelligence here. We couldn't talk about conspiracy unless Washington told us. I called Washington. They said, it's up to your local man. I called the local men back the same day. And I said, Mr. Nicely said, I think it's great that you're doing this work. I said, thank you. He said, that's wonderful. Keep it up. I said, keep it up for who? You have the United Press, the Associated Press, the prosecutors. You're telling the country one lone man was involved with all this activity. And we have a group that know it was otherwise. So he said, well, just do what you're doing. So anyway, I called the local FBI, and they had been at my house, seen a lot of the files, had seen information I had that they were totally unaware of. They don't even know what the MK Ultra is or many of the programs. I mean, if you gave them an IQ test on what's going on in current events, they'd all be fired. On a scale of 100, they'd be down at 30. That is the gospel truth. If you talk to them, they don't even know these books are out of this information is here, and they expect to solve the next crime more thoroughly than the other crime without knowing a darn thing about it. So the answer that the local FBI man said was, May, we can't go into everything you have. Well, Larry Nicely told the press, the Associated Press, the United Press, that they would go into this, that this was a very thorough investigation. And then they tell me, well, we can't go into everything you have. Now, the mention of Mr. Ruff on May the 6th, the U.S. attorney, I see no imminent action in this case. And I mentioned that briefly last week, apropos of an article in the Washington Post that gets even a little more scary. Ruff, this is the story, the front story. Ruff's, that's U.S. Attorney, move on the Hinckley case may speed a decision on replacement of the U.S. Attorney posts. And this is the article. The U.S. Attorney Charles Ruff's decision to personally prosecute President Reagan's alleged would-be assassin has pushed the White House towards an early decision on whether to replace U.S. Attorney Ruff in one of the considered most prestigious law enforcement jobs in the country. Because the U.S. Attorney decided to personally prosecute this John Hinckley Jr., it has pushed the same White House where the president was the victim of those bullets to replace Ruff from the job. And the article goes on, the case of John Hinckley Jr., accused of shooting Reagan, is expected to stretch out over the remainder of this year. That's 1981. And Ruff said it would be at least 2 months, and there are no indictment at least for 2 months. This will go for the remainder of the year. Replacing Mr. Ruff, who was appointed by Carter, would appear politically motivated and may be impractical, some people say. But a decision on Ruff is going to come in the very near future, and there's a possibility that the U.S. Attorney's job will be available, and there is now a search that's narrowed to two people, Joseph E. D. Genova, G-E-N-O-V-A, Chief Legal Counsel to the Senate Rules Committee, strong support from Howard Baker of Tennessee. Now, this is the state where he had special favors from the judge when he was arrested at the airport, who let him off with the 50 rounds of ammunition and the 3 guns and the handcuffs because he said he was law enforcement, Hinckley. And his brother went to Vanderbilt University, and there's a lot of interconnecting links to all the past assassinations in Tennessee. In fact, Memphis, Tennessee, where Martin Luther King was killed. And the Judiciary Committee Chairman Strom Thurmond is pushing for this particular man to try the case and get Ruff off. And Paul Laxalt of Nevada, who's being linked so closely through the years with Robert Mayhew, the CIA, the FBI, and the assassination teams, and also the boss of this DeGenova, who's Charles Mathias of Maryland. He's worked under him. Now, the other contender is Paul Friedman, a law partner of a Wall Street firm at the present time, who has the backing of Senator Barry Goldwater and has been active with him in the past. He was Barry Goldwater's lawyer. Ruff, a special Watergate prosecutor whose term isn't up until 1983, is being pushed out. And if this is the Washington Post, if the FBI moved immediately to appoint a successor to the U.S. Attorney Ruff, it would take several months before the nomination would be confirmed unless the normal procedures are somehow accelerated. Now, I wonder what kind of hanky-panky team this is that is protecting John Hinckley Jr., who took a pot shot at Ronald Reagan and did so much damage to the other people that were standing around there. Now, Larry nicely said, as I repeat, we will interview anyone. Theodore Gardner in the Washington Post, special agent of the FBI, said, these are quotes, "We are sensitive to the fact that the results of the investigation will receive the closest scrutiny in the future." They're getting it now. I'm not waiting till the future. The future is today. They said, "We know that this was the case in the investigation of Martin Luther King, of John Kennedy, of the Robert Kennedy assassination. The task force has conducted thousands of interviews and brought in computers to catalog information, and 100 tips have been received each day about alleged conspiracies." Iranians and Cubans have seemed particularly popular, as if these are seasonal flowers. Now they've separated them. Well, Cubans always were popular. They tried to pass off Fidel Castro wanting to kill John Kennedy for 17 years, so there's nothing new in that. But now they can throw Khomeini in, I guess, the Cubans and Fidel Castro. He said there are alleged plots involving some left-wingers, right-wingers, double agents, calls from abroad that Hinckley was in a number of countries. And they also denied that a woman had telephoned him in Washington, that she got another number by mistake, and that was mistakenly transferred to Hinckley's room. Now, this is the end of the first half hour. On the second half hour, I'm going into some more on the FBI report of the alleged assassin, the person who took the shots in Washington, and how the FBI is covering it up at this date. In the meantime, we'll take 1 minute break, and then I'll be on. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.